I'm Eileen Mancera, co-chair of PE Wins Communications Committee. For those of you joining for the first time, Moments That Made Her is a production of the Private Equity Women's Investor Network, also known as PE Win. We are the preeminent organization for senior-level women investment professionals in private equity. PE Win provides its members with opportunities to network, share ideas, make deep connections with peers, and empower each other to succeed. Our mission is to increase the profile of women in private equity, and our members represent institutions with over $3 trillion in assets under management. To learn more, please visit pewin.org. The host of Moments That Made Her is Kelly Williams. Many of you know Kelly as the founding chair of PE Win, as well as the founder of the legendary private market solution business known as Customized Fund Investment Group, which she and her team grew to manage $30 billion of assets under management until she let it sail in 2014. She is the CEO of the Williams Legacy Foundation and serves on the board of Greenbrier Companies and chairs the board of the Smithsonian American Art Museum. Thank you for joining us for today's episode.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Moments That Made Her. I'm Kelly Williams, your host and the founding chair of the Private Equity Women Investor Network and the chief executive officer of the Williams Legacy Foundation. Those of you who know me know that I love innovation, and so we're doing something a little innovative today. We've actually invited three guests to join us, and we're going to have a really interesting conversation about their background, and in particular, how, as three female founders, they made the decision to start their own firm. And so I'm delighted to introduce you and to welcome the founders of Reach Capital, Chantel Garvey, Jennifer Carolyn, and Wei-Yi Chu, who are the founders and partners of Reach Capital. Welcome, ladies, to Moments That Made Her.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Well, I'm delighted. And so, as I said, we're trying something a little new today. So we're going to talk about everybody's background and maybe ask a few fewer questions than we normally do, but that doesn't mean we're going to learn less about them because we definitely are going to dig in. So the first question I'm going to ask is my favorite question, which is, tell me a little bit about how and where you grew up. And Jennifer, maybe I'll direct it to you first.
Sure. So I grew up in Chicago and in the suburbs of Chicago. I grew up in a big family. I'm one of six kids, five girls, one boy. Grew up in the public schools, and I had this amazing experience when I was in high school where we moved into the city. My parents had gotten divorced, and I attended Chicago Public High School, Whitney Young, and I just had kind of two very different experiences attending public school, one in the suburbs, one in the inner city. And I think that had I didn't know it at the time, but in retrospect, had a formative impact on me and my decision to go into teaching and be really into education and specifically education equity and accessibility.
Well, that's interesting. I also went to public school, and people often ask me where I went to high school. I say Newburgh Free Academy, and the fact that the word free is in there is all you need to know that it's a public school, right? But I got an excellent education. My high school was in the inner city. Most of my schooling was in the inner city in the town I grew up in. And I count myself very fortunate to have been a very diverse school system. I think it really changed my life, made me who I am.
Was that in New York?
It was in Newburgh, New York, which is, you know, an upstate, very diverse community. And I grew up in the suburbs. I grew up in the town of Newburgh. The city of Newburgh is very different in terms of its makeup. But I would say my best experiences and my closest relationships came from going to a public school. And yep. So glad that I did. And I recommend everybody who has the opportunity to do that to have that experience.
Yeah.
Yep. So, Wei-Yi, how about you?
Yes, I actually was born in Queens, New York. My parents were both immigrants that came to the U.S. in the 1960s, left their family behind in China to pursue their own education. They knew one thing about the U.S. system, and it was if we can raise our daughter in a good zip code, she may have brighter outcomes. And so we moved to the suburbs of Connecticut. And I actually went through public school in a wonderful system in Southern Connecticut in Fairfield County. I had a great public school experience, but I was definitely a latchkey kid starting at a very young age. I had parents who took two or three jobs so they could live in the town I grew up in. And so I deeply value the education that was allotted to me. I went on to a public higher ed institution as well. And it is little surprise, given the values instilled in my own upbringing, what led me to reach and to join a team with, and as you will hear, we all have very different lived education experiences, yet the values instilled really all brought us together around the same mission.
And like you, I was a latchkey kid. Both my parents worked. My mom worked from the time my sister and I were very young. And again, I think that made us very independent. We knew how to take care of ourselves. I think we were pretty responsible. I have to check with my mom on that one. But yeah, I think that it's probably something you don't hear as much about today, but certainly it was not unusual at all when I was a kid growing up. And Chantel, how about you?
So I'll start with my parents. Both my parents come from low-income backgrounds. My mom is from Omaha, Nebraska. And my dad is from Philadelphia, and they saw education as their way out of poverty and to better opportunities. So they actually met at the University of Denver. They both majored in accounting. So accounting and finances is a little bit in my blood. So I was born in Denver, Colorado. I went to school there, also public school, until I was in high school. I actually moved the middle of my freshman year in high school. I had to move. My mom ended up becoming a professor in North Carolina. And so we moved the family. And that was another eye-opening experience for me. Not just, you know, having to make new friends in a new high school, but also thinking about what would be my new education experience. And so my school in Denver was a strong high school. But when I got to North Carolina, I was told I needed to be in remedial classes. Basically, they said this was a harder high school. I wouldn't be prepared and be able to take on the rigorous coursework. Now, of course, again, education was high priority in my household, so this was not something my mom was supportive of. So she went to school. It was a really strong advocate, talked to the principals and said, my daughter needs to be in these challenging courses. And so thanks to her, got me into challenging courses, got to take AP classes. I ended up being valedictorian of that high school. But again, had my mom not had that advocacy for me, had she not been able to push and get me into the most rigorous courses, that would have never happened. So just really owe a lot of my education experience to her and her advocacy. And then again, just really making sure that education was at the center of our household.
So did you find that you were not prepared for those classes, or was that just an assumption that people made?
It was an assumption. And I'm an African-American female, so you could say that assumption was based on what I look like. And to be fair, most of the students that look like me were in the remedial classes at that high school. And so I think it was just an assumption and that, you know, I wouldn't be able to handle the more rigorous coursework.
Can I just mention something here? It's interesting because I then had the opposite experience. I went to this Chicago public school. And I was put into all of the honors courses without even testing, and because it was a majority African-American school. And hopefully things are changing. This tracking system within schools is a real thing.
This is so interesting. I have to be honest with you guys. I mean, I thought I'd heard about every version of discrimination. I have not heard about this or thought about this. And I think it's unique to the fact that you guys both transferred.
Mm-hmm. Yep,
yeah, and did. I think it's also unique to the fact that there is no real standard curriculum across the U.S., right? So it is true that if you go to one high school, the curriculum is different, the rigor is different. And so it is hard for schools to kind of assess where you may be. So that's also one of the challenges as students make their way through different high schools or through different schools growing up.
And there's not an equitable system to, in many schools, assign students into the honors, the regular track and the remedial track. And many times it's based on default systems that are not equitable.
Right. You know, this conversation is making me think a little bit about the organization SEO, which you probably know about, sponsored. Well, it used to be called Sponsors for Educational Opportunity. Now I think they say it means seizing every opportunity. But it's an institution I've been involved with for a long time that helps students go from high school, mostly inner city students go from high school to college. And they tend to find students in eighth grade who are top scorers in their school. And they find out that if you're an A student in like an inner city middle school or high school, you may be like a B minus or C plus student in a private school. But what they find is putting them through the SEO program, by the end of the program, they're scoring higher than the kids in the private schools. And so, again, it's not that ability is evenly distributed, but opportunity is not. And this is a really interesting example. Again, not one that I thought of, but I guess if you have families that are moving around and moving into different schools, and because there is not that consistency in terms of education and scoring and mapping people, you can be made assumptions. And if you don't have parents who can be your advocate or someone to be your advocate, a lot of students don't get to take advantage of the opportunities that should be made available to them.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Well, Kelly, to add, my reason for going into education was 8 years working with SEO in New York City. So we can go into that later, but it's an incredible organization.
It is. Okay. So you share that passion.
Yes.
Given those backgrounds, where you're coming from, where you're educated, tell me a little bit about your path to private equity. And Chantel, let me start with you on that one. What made you think about pursuing a career? And are there particular key moments that led you in that direction?
So I always like to start by saying I didn't know what a venture capitalist even was until I actually became one. So I have a very atypical path. It was never something I pursued or was a goal of mine. I started my career as a chemical engineer at Procter & Gamble. Loved that work. Loved doing research. I actually worked on laundry products, Downy and Tide. But I also did a lot of mentoring and tutoring on the side and really saw that was where my passion was. It was really something in education. Decided I didn't necessarily want to go the teaching route, but was really thinking about this intersection of education, technology. So left my job actually at Procter & Gamble after 5 years, decided to go back to school. I did a dual degree in business and education at Stanford with the eventual goal of actually joining a startup or starting an ed tech company. Fast forward, and we'll get into this, but met Jennifer Carolyn while I was at Stanford, and she was working at a nonprofit called New Schools Venture Fund, and she convinced me to come work with her, was very against the idea. I did not want to be on the funding side. I saw myself as a builder, an operator, didn't want to be just sitting in an office writing checks. That was my initial impression of what funders did. But long story short, she convinced me, went over to New Schools Venture Fund. We started doing some small investing in building out the tech ecosystem. And then we spun out and created a venture fund, Reach Capital, which we'll go into the story of. So again, it was never part of the path, fell into it, knew I had a passion for education, like the intersection of education technology. And then as we saw the companies that we were investing in starting to grow, we really realized that we could grow our impact by building and creating Reach.
Great. So Wei, you mentioned a little bit about your time at SEO. You know, tell us a little bit about how you made your way to private equity.
Sure. Similar to Chantel, it doesn't feel as linear as one may perceive because I did work on Wall Street after college, but I started as a pre-med major undergrad just purely by default, and organic chemistry really just weeded me right out of there. So my default was econ. And it's interesting, the stereotype of a lot of Asian immigrant families really revering engineering and to be really revere the occupations of being an engineer and doctor resonated with me. So going into econ and potentially business seemed a little far-fetched for my parents. But I did keep one thing in mind. My parents, they saved all their life to support me through college, which I deeply appreciate. But they were very clear. The next day after graduation, I was on my own. And so I had a lot burning in my belly to be employed after college. I think what ultimately led me to venture early, my early career was just doors opening from very key mentors. And my first was Hal Varian. He's a econ professor at Michigan and now a very prominent economist at Google. Gave me an opportunity to research with him in my macro econ class junior year, which then opened my eyes to considering finance. It's worth noting Morgan Stanley did not recruit outside of the Ivy Leagues at the time, but there was one female MD who was a Michigan alum who always came back for her one analyst spot. And so I knew it was a coveted spot. I worked very hard to get it, but that door just opened the next door. After joining the Morgan Stanley analyst class, I worked in equity research for many years on the sell side at Merrill Lynch. And it was that time in New York for 8 years that I sought SEO as a way to relieve my work on Wall Street and support other students, particularly in the Bronx. And that was my introduction to the Achievement Gap, knowing the supports I had in my own school system around college readiness. And so when we moved out to San Francisco in 2004, I didn't even know that entrepreneurship, technology, and technology could be a thing. But you drink the Kool-Aid fast. And I sat next to Jennifer at New Schools Venture Fund. We shared a cubicle. And I really started to learn more about the idea of seeding social entrepreneurs and as agents of change. So I never knew what venture capital was or Silicon Valley or understood the power of entrepreneurship until later, arguably later in my career when I joined New Schools Venture Fund. So that is the path that I took and excited to be actually involved with SEO's Bay Area effort to support their students as well. So it has come full circle a bit.
Great. Well, now, Jennifer, now I'm excited to hear your path. These have been great stories.
I've heard Chantel's Ways story so many times, and I still love hearing it. There's still like new pieces I learn. So I started my career as a teacher in Chicago when I was 21, and I taught for 7 years in the public schools. I came out to California, Silicon Valley. My husband was getting his MBA at Stanford, and then I fell in love with the school and the Valley. And so I also went to Stanford to get my master's in curriculum and teacher education. And it was there I saw the founder of New Schools Ventures Fund speak, Kim Smith. She's like this icon of kind of nonprofit education, philanthropy, venture philanthropy, and begged her for a job, got my foot in the door. I think I was the only non-MBA aside from Wei. And that's where, unbeknownst to us at the time, New Schools was started by these legendary venture capitalists. New Schools was like the tiger of the nonprofit venture philanthropy world because they've spun out so many funds and entrepreneurs and builders. It's really amazing. So we worked there for many years with Wei, and I can remember, it's interesting thinking back, I can remember the days that I met Chantel and Wei. And like, you remember those moments? I mean, a lot of people, I don't remember like the moments I meet them, but I remember those moments that I met these two ladies, and they were very different. It was like Chantel was in the class I was teaching at Stanford at the time, and Wei was on my first day. I was next to the elevators, I remember. And it was interesting to think back, like, you know, that we would be in a partnership together for so long. So again, I didn't know anything about venture capital. Never really heard of it where I grew up. And so the concepts behind it, though, were so exciting and intriguing and made so much sense to me. So we were very lucky to learn the basics of venture capital in this organization called New Schools. And that maybe we'll get to that place where we decided eventually to leave and start our own. But that's where I was first introduced to the concept.
So interestingly, through all of your stories, you all mentioned the fact that you'd never heard of venture capital and entrepreneurship. And I'm not sure if that's something unique to women. Maybe men don't hear about it as either as young people, but certainly there are organizations that have been set up now to improve female financial literacy. And then you have Girls Who Invest, who tries to prepare women for these careers. But given your experience in the education space and Jennifer, your experience as a teacher, are there points in time where it might make sense, it might be a natural thing to actually teach children about entrepreneurship and venture capitalism? It's actually, you know, my thought is it could be kind of fun. It could be a game, right? Shark Tank is a fun thing. But are there natural inflection points where maybe it would be a good idea for young people to learn about it?
Well, I'll just mention in teaching, I feel that when I was going into the teaching profession, my mother was a nurse, and at that time in female dominated professions, nursing and teaching is 77% women for K-12. There was almost a overtone of negativity around for profits and financial, you know, making money. And when I went to the ed school at the time, I think it's changing, but there was almost that. There was definitely a debate between should education startups be just nonprofit or was it okay? And when I did the research, I learned that almost everything in our schools is for profit. The desks, the whiteboards, the software, the attendance software. And that's when I started peeling back the layers and saying, hey, wait a minute, who's funding these things and how do they get to market? So I do feel that at least in ed schools I'll speak to that there's a lack of education around private equity and just how these companies are formed and how they get to market.
And I think you can start even earlier, like you were saying, make it fun, do Shark Tank. I actually did a story for one of our portfolio companies, Seesaw, where they actually made a book about me, like what is it like to be a venture capitalist? So early on, students now are getting exposed to my day-to-day. And then you can embed little hands-on projects that would actually make you a venture capitalist or give you exposure to what that work looks like. So we did a fake pitch with them. So they had to look at a company, look at the idea, and then decide, would you give this company money or not? So you could do things like that. And then I just think in general, introducing the concept of entrepreneurship early is so important, and a lot about creativity, a lot about how do you bootstrap something? How do you grow a business? Like that can start even at the earliest stages.
And I think it can be interdisciplinary if you're thinking about history and learning what our businesses, whose backs the businesses have been built off of. So many of all our ancestries have come from different lines, from the Irish to the Chinese, right? It's across the board. And I think there's an interdisciplinary approach to introduce the idea of entrepreneurship and financial literacy in what we're already teaching.
Yeah, I agree. I feel really strongly about this because I've always been very frustrated that our industry gets demonized, particularly by Washington, right? We're always the Wall Street fat cats, the bad guys. And I always say, look, my view is that we are the greatest country in the world, not because we have the greatest military or the greatest industrial complex. It's because we're the finance capital of the world and everyone has to come here. And that is this is a center of excellence. America is a center of excellence for finance. And we ought to be proud of that and embrace that and celebrate that and stop making it be a bad thing to make money. This idea, Jennifer, I think it's fascinating that you said careers that women often gravitate towards or led towards are ones that are not meant to make a lot of money.
Yeah. And
money is a bad thing. I mean, I don't think that's by accident. But I remember when I was at Credit Suisse, they had, you know, take your sons and daughters to work day. I started a program to bring kids in from the foster care system to come in on that day because many of them didn't have a parent per se to take them. And so we worked with agencies in New York City to do that. And for my division, private equity, we set up a little Shark Tank. We had a couple of our VPs come up with business ideas and pitch them. And we gave the kids monopoly money and they could go up and vote with their dollars which idea they like the best. And I think it's very intuitive. I think it's something children understand, but I think if we learn about that part of our system earlier for everybody, men and women, and girls and boys, I think it's a good thing. I think it's, in some ways, it's a civic duty. We really ought to understand how the finance part of our country works and make sure that people see that there are opportunities, way to your point, there are opportunities everywhere for everyone to make money. You just have to not be dissuaded from doing it.
Yeah, one of the things that we do too, to your point around just exposure, we have a pretty robust internship program. We actually have high school interns, undergraduate interns, and even graduate interns. And we really try to select from people who would not have backgrounds or would not have exposure to venture capital. And we know that this business is very network-based, very relationship-based. And a lot of times what you find is the current VCs, they just have their kids come in or people who are well-connected, get them an internship. And so we really try to look for those students who don't have that opportunity and bring them in for a summer to get that exposure.
Yeah.
Yeah. And somewhat related, I know Jennifer, as a parent of three and myself, have this conversation all the time. Having a job as a young person is so critical. To be honest, I was not really an academic. I did okay in school, but I was a doer and I learned by doing and I held down a job since sixth grade. I've had a job through middle school, high school. I worked all through college. And I just hope that piece isn't lost, that early entry job when you're a teenager and learning to be accountable, responsible, the financial literacy that comes with that. We have a work integrated learning thesis in our investments and how we can integrate earlier work opportunities for K-12 and higher ed. But I do feel a little bit with this next generation that is lost in terms of working hard manual labor jobs in the summer, which many of us did, and what that taught us about money and reward and responsibility.
Yep.
Yeah, I would agree. I think that's, in my experience doing the podcast, I think there's a common thread. I think almost all of my guests have had, you know, a job as a teenager and kind of learned that and had maybe even had a really important mentor that came at that point in their lives who encouraged them. So we are going to take a quick break.
We would like to take a brief break to thank PEWIN's founding partner, KPMG, as well as our gold partners, Asia Alternatives, Dukas Linden Public Relations, Kane Anderson, Kirkland & Ellis, Proskauer, Silver Lake, Thoma Bravo, and TPG. If you are interested in sponsorship opportunities, please contact us at info@pewin.org. Now back to our episode.
Welcome back to Moments That Made Her. I'm Kelly Williams. I'm here today with Jennifer Carolyn, Chantelle Garvey, and Wei-Yi Chu, the founders of Reach Capital. And now I'd really love to hear you guys tell me a little bit about how you came together to found this firm. And Jennifer, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Okay. It's not a smooth and elegant story. So to sum it up, we couldn't get our deals through at New Schools Venture Fund. So Wei and I were very interested in education technology, and the organization was investing in both nonprofits and for-profits. And Wei had started a ed tech incubator, and she was running that to great success. And it has, in fact, in the first cohort was, a unicorn today. Degreed was in that first cohort. And she and I was involved in it as well. And we were collaborating in a lot of different ways because I really enjoyed working with her. And so we were trying to get our deals through and they were not getting through. So we decided that we needed to form an entity that was outside of New Schools. So the powers that be at the time at New Schools, and it was not well received. And then we said, okay, then we're going to have to leave and start this new organization. And then they said, okay, well, let's start it within New Schools first. So we started our first fund. It was a $10 million seed fund, was started within New Schools Venture Fund, but it was entirely separate in that we raised our own money. We had our own P&L. We ran our own office. We made our own decisions. And that was super important to us, is that we had decision-making power, and we fought quite hard for that power. That fund did really well. So this is when we hired Chantel as the third founder of our group. And I was teaching the class, had met her. She was the best student in the class and asked the best questions and thought very big. And that's when I called her and said, what are you doing next year? And she said she was going to an ed tech company. And I said, wait a minute, come and join us on this crazy idea. And it was crazy at the time. And then she joined us, and that's how we came together. And then the success of the seed fund led us to say, hey, let's do this outside and into its own separate entity that was truly set up like a traditional venture fund. And when we did it, it felt very, what's the word? It felt very risky and felt very, a lot of people came to us and said, this is not going to work. You need to hire a man. We got all kinds of comments, and education doesn't deserve its own fund. And we went ahead and we raised that very first fund in 2015. It was hard, but that's how we got started. I don't know. What am I missing, Chantel, in way?
I think the other backdrop, just what was happening at the time. So I graduated 2012. That's when I joined Wayne Jin at New Schools. If you recall, that was when the iPad had just come out. Devices were just going to schools. So we really were in this kind of EdTech 1.0 phase, and we really did hit the market at the right time. And again, we were able to see some of today's category leaders in the industry, because we were really able to understand how are these devices going to be used in the classroom and how is education and learning going to change. And so really leveraging that moment in time with devices, bring your own device to school, how are teachers' teaching practices going to change? And that really helped us, I think, build again those early category leaders that then helped to raise Reach One as we spun out of New Schools.
Yeah.
I think what I'd add, let's be clear, we had amazing VC mentors. They were men. Brooke Byers and John Doerr they took us under their wing. They guided us. We probably wouldn't have known half of what we do know now from learning from them early days. But the fundraising piece, I remember we were running like a call center for hours on end, calling every family member's friends, everyone we knew to fundraise. And we had such deep conviction, and 99% of those calls were, oh, education, how nice. Oh, that's so nice that
so
you're
cute.
Starting. So cute. But we were convinced that there was a market opportunity here to capitalize on. So it started, this job remains humble to this day, but it was a deeply humbling experience raising $53 million, which I never saw what $1 million looked like around the vision.
Yeah. One thing I just remembered, Wei, we also had, there was at least two women on the board of New Schools that were also great advocates. I don't want to leave them out. And that was Lauren Powell and Joanna Reese. And I feel like those two women too really supported us. There was many men as well, John Doerr and Brooke Byers and Rob Stavis, but we also had two great women.
So interesting, Jennifer, that you said, you know, kind of the part of the impetus was the fact that you were getting your deals through. And I think this is a phenomenon that a lot of women, they experience, and it's a bit of a something misunderstood in the private equity industry, because I think there's this view that once women become partners and you're leading deals, that, okay, we've done our part. You've made it to the top. There's nothing more to complain about. And people don't realize that for women, first of all, because there aren't that many of us who do make it to those ranks. But second of all, it is very isolated sometimes. And it's often the case, I hear this all the time from women, that they have a hard time getting their deals through. And as a result, they aren't able to develop the same track record that men are. They aren't able to bank the same amount of money in terms of carry and bonuses. And this becomes a real hindrance in sort of advancing their career, whether it's inside the firm or going out to spin out. And so I talk a little bit about that, if you would, your perspective on that. And what have you done differently in setting up Reach? Obviously, you guys are the decision makers, but how does your experience, your prior experience, impact the way you guys set up and think about doing deals at Reach?
Yeah, I'll comment on just the deals through. And Chantel and Wayne, maybe you guys can talk about some of the stuff that we have, how we have set it up. But I remember my first deal that I did not get through. And I, after the investment committee meeting, everyone left the room. And I remember crying and by myself in that room. And I was so upset because I had such, I mean, now I look back, I was like, wow, I was very emotional about that. But I had a lot of conviction and I did not feel that they understood the education industry, technology industry, and what and the changes that Chantel was talking about in the way that I did at that at that moment. And then that happened a number of different times. And then I just hit a wall and just didn't want to do that anymore. And then it became clear that it needed to happen in a firm that was populated by team members that understood the how we were seeing the world a little bit differently, what we were seeing. And I'm not saying that, and you're not trying to throw anyone under the bus, but it just was that the firm was investing in a lot of different things. And we were highly focused on education technology. So we just were, we understood it in different ways. That was what we experienced. And it was one of the big reasons why we left.
And I'll say one of the things that we brought with us to Reach is that understanding that people have different understandings of different sectors, different markets, and we really value that expertise. So at Reach, all of us do education. We do everything from early childhood up through K-12, post-secondary, adult learning. But each of us kind of have different areas that we have been building expertise in. So Jen, for example, being an educator, she really deeply understands K-12. I've been going very deeply into adult learning. Wei's gone very deeply into mental health, mental supports for schools. And so we really value that. So when someone's coming with with strong conviction in an area that they're deep in, that's really helpful. The other thing that we've done is we really want to build our junior team, build their muscle. And again, allow them to take risks. So we actually give each of our investment partners a small pool of money that they can make an investment that actually doesn't have to go through the process. So one, this is an outlet. If there's really a deal that you have strong conviction, you really love, you have some money that you can make that investment. And then two, just again, to build that muscle. We never want the process or the investment committee to be a blocker into making great investments. So that's some of the things that we've brought over to Reach.
And to add to Chantel's last point, we actually, our junior partners have investment making decisions. It's tiered. But the earlier you can work that muscle and say, I own and be part and accountable for an investment decision is very powerful and highly motivating. And for many firms, you actually don't get that release valve or that ability to vote until you're very tenured. And we wanted to start that much earlier in the process. And we can help evaluate the right fits for the team as well earlier on by doing so.
I have to say that's very innovative. I'm not aware of another firm that does that. I don't know if you guys are. I'm interested to know how did your LPs or how do they respond to that?
That's a good question. So they had a lot of questions about it, I will say. And we started then tracking the results of that money. And then we could clearly prove with our financial results that it was worth it. There was a program that was worth it. Like if you, so this is a small amount of capital that everybody gets. And if you could show out of those 10 investments, one or two of them became outlier, you know, it's well worth the risk for that capital.
I would say LPs are interested in the fact that we're building Reach as a legacy firm. So they're really interested in make sure that we are building that muscle of our junior partners. So they do like to see, hey, this is a way to really build the investment performance of your younger partners. And so they were really interested in that aspect as well.
Yeah, I think this is great. I mean, I kind of feel like you can probably get away with it a little more in the venture capital world because as an LP, we expect a high percentage to fail. So if you're playing a little bit with the house's money, that's okay. But as you say, if the result is 20% of them are screamers, then it worked. That's what we expect.
Yeah.
So, yeah. No, I think it's terrific. I love the idea. Well, I could keep going, and I'm already planning for the next time I have you back on Moments That Made Her. But I want to move to one of our favorite parts of the program, which is our lightning round. And I'm going to ask some quick questions, ask you guys to respond to them, and it'll give us a little insight into your personality. So my first question, and Wei, I'll start with you. What is a great book you have read or listened to recently?
I am currently going deep on San Francisco, and so I'm in the middle of Season of the Witch, which goes into the history of San Francisco right now. And I lived in the city for 20 years, so deeply invested and just eye-opening. Wow. Wonderful book.
Good one. Chantel, how about you?
I'm reading an oldie, but a goodie. So I'm reading about Steve Jobs and just really going back through his life, like what made him such a visionary. And it's just good to see, again, what a great leader he was and what were some of the things that he was really passionate about. For example, that intersection design and technology and how that was able to manifest itself in a strong Apple brand. So
good. That is a good one. Jennifer, mm-hmm. How about you?
I love to read. I'm usually reading a couple of books, nonfiction and fiction. And so I'm almost done with Covenant of Water, which I've loved, my fiction book. And then I just have to mention the last two nonfiction because they were so good. American Prometheus, which Oppenheimer was based on, and Walter Isaacson biography to Einstein, which was just awesome too.
All good ones. Wow. So what's your cell phone wallpaper, Jennifer?
Nothing, actually. I'm looking at it now.
This is a first. I've never gotten that response before.
Replaced it or knew how to fix it or something. I don't know. No, there's no picture on my wallpaper.
Oh my gosh, that's so funny. Wei, how about you?
It's always my favorite child, my Vishla Ruby. She's my mom. She's my most well-behaved child. Not my favorite. My most well-behaved.
Chantel, how about you?
I'm glad you asked this. I had this on here and I forgot why I put it here, but it's palm trees that are blowing in the wind. And what it's supposed to represent is palm trees, when they blow, they actually bend and they don't break. And so this idea that you can go through storms and just bend and make you a better person and not, they won't break you. So...
yes, resilient. Well, I live in Palm Beach, so I see that all the time.
Yeah.
So, Wei, if you had a career other than private equity, what would it be?
Oh, my partners know this. I'd be in the contemporary art world. I'd be a curator.
Very good. That's a passion we share. We'll have to talk about that.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Jennifer, how about you?
Teaching. I hope someday to go back to teaching, too.
Great. And Chantel?
I'd either be a youth minister or a hip-hop dancer.
Why not both?
Yeah, both.
You would be the coolest minister around.
Yes.
I love it. Well, then, while I'm with you, Chantel, are you a dog or a cat person?
Neither.
Neither.
Not a pet person.
A first for
me? Well, I'm allergic to both. That's the main reason.
Oh, okay. Well, there you go. All right. Wei, I think I know your answer.
Definitely dog.
And Jennifer, how about you?
I have two havanese, so dogs.
Ah. And what's the best piece of advice you've ever been given, Jennifer?
Gosh, this is so hard to sum it up. Maybe when I kind of went into the business world from teaching, I think I struggled a little bit with how do I retain my identity as like a teacher, kind of nurture and be strong in business. And I think the best piece of advice I was given is that you don't have to sacrifice nurturing and warmth and caring and be strong. And so I just have really taken that. I really believe in that and have tried to take that with me.
I couldn't agree more. That's really the approach I've had in building my business and growing my business, is you could still you can still be very human and care about people. You don't have to be like cutthroat. I still remember when I started my firm, we had this assistant who just was not working out. And the co-head of the business, who was a man, wanted to let her go, but wasn't going to keep her around for a while. And she sensed there was something going on, and she was a single mom. And I finally sat her down and I told her. And she was so grateful because she knew she had to make some plans. And he was like, why did you tell her we weren't ready for her to know yet? And I said, we owed it to her. And he said, you actually care. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh my God, and you actually don't. Like, that was just a horrifying discovery among many that I made over time. But yeah, I mean, I actually think it, the level of loyalty you get from people, money can't buy that kind of loyalty. And so when you actually do have empathy and sympathy and indicate to the people who work with you, who put so much time and energy, that you care about them and you recognize it, it's really meaningful.
Yep.
So how about you, Chantel? What's the best piece of advice you've ever been given?
I would say the moment you realize that you're no longer getting joy or fulfillment or finding purpose in your role, that should be your last day. And I think sometimes people stay in roles for too long when they know it doesn't suit them. And I go back to that day leaving Procter & Gamble. It was a big jump. I'm going to a completely different career. But I knew, like, you know, that day that, you know, there was a different path for me. So.
And Wei, I'm going to give you the last word here.
Yeah, well, mine was somewhat similar to Chantel's. I was raised with the value of humility, which this is probably coming from the more loud, extroverted, obnoxious partner here. But I actually never deeply valued it growing up, especially just the stereotype in Asian culture around it. And it made it sound like less than. And yet the older I get, knowing how humbling this job is and actually how that drives and motivates us all, right? The, in terms of losing deals and fundraising and seeing companies go up and down, this job is all about humility. And I feel like if I ever get too comfortable or not humble enough, that Chantel, that is my sign where this is, you are not, you, it's time to transition out of venture. So I never want to feel too comfortable. Comfort is not the steady state in venture. If you want comfort, you don't be a founder or don't be a venture capitalist. So I'd say staying humble.
That's great. Well, this has been such a fantastic conversation. I want to thank Jennifer, Chantel, and Wei for being my guests today. This won't be the last time we see them because I'm definitely going to invite them back. But thank you again for being on Moments That Made Her.
Thank you, Kelly.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
This is wonderful.
Thank you for joining us for today's episode of Moments That Made Her. I'm Scotty Wardell, co-chair of the PE Win Communications Committee. As a reminder, the content in this recording is for general information purposes only and does not constitute advice. We give no assurance or warranty regarding accuracy, timeliness, or applicability of any of the contents of this recording. This recording is provided as is, and PE Win expressly disclaims any and all warranties expressed or implied to the extent permitted by law. Except where acknowledged, the copyright and all intellectual property rights in all material in this recording are owned by PE Win and our affiliates and should not be reproduced without our prior written consent. Other organizations or brand names used within this recording are for identification purposes only. The content set forth in this recording may not be sold, reproduced, or distributed without PE Win's prior written consent. Any third-party trademarks, service marks, and logos are the property of their respective owners. Any further rights not specifically granted herein are reserved. Thank you again for joining us today, and we hope you tune in for another episode soon.